Good afternoon, I'm John Mahan, WINY News, joined with a very special guest today on the WINY Afternoon Show. We have U.S. Senator from Connecticut, Richard Blumenthal. How are you doing today, Senator?
I'm doing great. Putnam is one of my favorite places in the world. Always great to be with WINY because it does such a wonderful job in this area, and with two of my good friends, Ron Cordier and Tom Borner, and couldn't be better.
Thank you. We appreciate your time today, and we wanted to ask you a little bit about what you're doing here in northeastern Connecticut today. As I understand, you have a few stops planned.
I have a number of stops. I want to see some of the job development that's taking place at the industrial park. I want to look at the YMCA new construction project. I'm meeting with veterans because I want to listen to them. In fact, I just met with a group in New London talking about veterans' homelessness. Transportation is a big issue today on my agenda, how the rail links between here and New London, the new rail grants that we've gotten from Washington, how they'll be implemented. I want to know really more than anything about job creation and economic growth here in northeastern Connecticut.
Absolutely. And at the Veterans Forum, I imagine that one thing that might come up is mental health. And I know that in Putnam, there's been a lot of discussion lately about the possibility of having a mental health facility like a treatment center over at the John D. Dempsey Center. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with that proposal, if you heard anything about it, but that's something that we've been focusing on a lot in Putnam right now. It's something that we've covered a lot in our reports. Could you comment a little bit about the need right now for mental health treatment for veterans in Connecticut?
I am a strong supporter of that program and of more mental health care for veterans generally, and more mental health care for everyone who needs it. It's one of those really pressing crises, and it has ramifications in all kinds of other areas like heroin overdose, which requires mental health services and treatment, crime, particularly juvenile justice, which requires more mental health intervention, violence or conflict in our schools, gun violence, all of them having a connection to mental health. But healthcare for veterans particularly affects me as the member, ranking member of the Veterans Affairs Committee in the United States Senate. That means I'm the top Democrat on the Veterans Affairs Committee. And I wrote a law, it's called the Clay Hunt Veterans Suicide Prevention Act, John, because believe it or not, in this country, the greatest, strongest country in the history of the world, 22 veterans every day take their own lives. That is a disgrace. Shameful. So I joined with John McCain, a Republican from Arizona, as you know.
Yes.
And he and I wrote a bill that will provide more mental health care for veterans to deal with post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury and the invisible wounds of war, the mental health needs that they have that cause them to take their own lives, those wounds that they bring back with them that often cause them to lose that war against the deep hole of depression. And one of the most moving days of my life in the United States Senate was to stand next to John McCain and next to Clay Hunt's mom. We went to the White House as the president signed that bill. And I looked out and I saw Joanna Eldridge, whose husband, Justin Eldridge, from southeastern Connecticut, took his life, and other military families who have suffered from this problem. So mental health care for veterans, absolutely a priority for me as a United States Senator, as the ranking member of the Veterans Affairs Committee, as a citizen, as, frankly, somebody who cares about our veterans.
Certainly a big topic, I would imagine, when you're stopping by today here in Putnam. And we also had some questions while we're speaking about veterans. You know, national security has been a real issue for a long time in this country, especially right now with the Iran nuclear deal that we've kind of seen a big division going on in Congress. We've seen a big division going on in terms of public opinion on that particular matter. Do you support the deal as proposed, and what are its strengths and weaknesses, and what could the consequences be if the agreement is not signed?
This decision, whether to support the agreement or not, will be one of the most consequential that I face. And so I am using this time to review very, very carefully, word by word, the agreement itself, all of the documents that are part of the agreement. Some of them are classified, receiving briefings from the top officials involved in the negotiation, including at the very top of our United States government, both classified and open, and of course talking to people who are on both sides of the issue. And to answer your question very directly, I have not yet taken a position. I will probably toward the end of this month or beginning of September. But I want to devote the 60 days that Congress has to really dig down and delve into all of the details. And it's an immensely complex decision. What are the reasons to support it? Well, it offers the possibility of a non-nuclear armed Iran. In other words, it fulfills one of the major objectives, which is to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. On the other hand, I have questions about the verification, sufficiency of the enforcement, the 24-day period that Iran can take before it permits access by the IAEA inspectors, the sufficiency of that process within the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Enforcement Body, and also about the effectiveness of the so-called snapback or the restoration of sanctions, if necessary. But the question is not whether it's the best agreement, it's whether it is better than the alternatives. And if I want one thing more than anything, it's to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, which would be a threat to our country, but also to avoid war, armed conflict, which is a major priority for me because I've seen firsthand, having been to Afghanistan 3 times, having a son who's served in Afghanistan in the Marine Corps Reserve, having another son in the Navy right now. I know, as one of the few members of Congress who has children in the armed services, that these costs to the United States, we still have not paid from the past wars.
Now, right before I began speaking with you, I was talking with the mayor of Putnam, Tony Falzarano, and he had a question for you. He was wondering, how can we trust Iran, and is it worth signing an agreement with a country that we can't trust, in his opinion? What would be your response to that?
Very good question. We cannot trust Iran. You know the old saying, Ronald Reagan, trust but verify?
Right.
This one has to be verify and verify. No trust. Which is why, going back to the point that I made earlier, we have to be sure of the enforcement and verification method. We have to be sure we have access, not only to the declared sites like Fordo and so forth, but also to the potentially undeclared suspicion-raising sites. And he is absolutely right. Trust? Forget about it. Verify if the agreement is approved? Yes. And then we need to be prepared to enforce it through sanctions. And the military option needs to be continuing on the table. As much as I may want to avoid armed conflict, the military option has to continue to be on the table, whether this agreement is approved or not.
For those of you guys just tuning in, we're speaking with U.S. Senator from Connecticut, Richard Blumenthal. I wanted to move on to another topic here. This is something that we've run some stories on in our newsroom, and it's caused some concern, both support and some criticisms in the local community. Now, in New York, the state's labor board is expected to approve a phased-in minimum wage of $15 an hour for fast food workers. Some lawmakers in Connecticut have suggested the same for our state. Do you believe it is ethical to apply different minimum wage standards to different industries? And if such a proposal were to make it to the federal level, would you consider supporting it?
I've supported raising the minimum wage because I believe it's good for workers and good for our economy. And to answer your question, I think that it ought to be applied broadly without distinctions among different industries. The fast food industry is a good place to start, but I think that raising the minimum wage, whatever the level, and at the federal level, it won't go to $15, but we need to raise it above what it is right now. And I support it because, remember, John, it's good for those workers, but they're going to be spending that money on all kinds of stuff, whether it's food or rent or furniture or cars that then generate economic growth. And that's one of the reasons I support it.
Now, when you say it's a good place to start, does that mean that you would be okay with the idea of tackling different industries at different times, or would you insist that they all be raised together at the same time?
I want to look at the legislation. I think the broader the better.
Absolutely. Okay, so another question that we have is, in the midst of the financial crisis that's going on in Puerto Rico, you've recently helped introduce some legislation, as I understand, that will grant Puerto Rico the authority to readjust its debts just like other states can do under the supervision of a bankruptcy court. With more than 250,000 Puerto Ricans living in Connecticut, could you explain how this legislation could help those who may have family and friends living on the island, and what would be your counterargument to those who feel that the territory should be successfully seeking statehood before entering and earning the privileges of a state?
Great question. Puerto Rico, alone among the territories and among the commonwealths and among our states, it's not a state, you're absolutely right, but the principle has been that the bankruptcy code should apply to everyone. Why is that? Well, the bankruptcy code actually serves the interests not only of the debtor, but also of the creditors. In this case, the folks who've bought those bonds that evidence the debt that's owed them. The bondholders are ordinary Americans. Some of them are mutual funds. Some of them are people who live in Puerto Rico. If Puerto Rico can't pay its debt, the purpose of the bankruptcy code is to permit an orderly workout. In other words, resolving those debts, not simply shirking them,
right,
not abandoning them, but working out a plan to pay them. That's the purpose of Chapter 9, which has been used in Detroit and Stockton and Jefferson County. It's used around the country when municipalities or public entities cannot pay the debts they owe. Well, in Puerto Rico, it's their electric utility. And all I'm proposing is that that utility and a couple of other public authorities and municipalities have the same abilities as any city or town in Connecticut or around the country. The people of Puerto Rico, I'll be very blunt, have kind of been on a roller coaster a couple of decades ago. The tax code favored industry moving down there. Then the tax benefits were revoked. Unemployment has been very high. Medicaid and Medicare is provided at a much lower level than elsewhere in the United States. And whether Puerto Rico is a state or not, its citizens right now are U.S. citizens. In other words, they're Americans.
Right.
And their families are here. If they move from there, they're coming here. And so better to increase employment there, end the discrimination against Puerto Rico there, provide opportunities for economic development there, because if we don't there, we'll have to do it here. And it's ultimately a matter of fundamental fairness. Their municipalities ought to be treated the same as ours.
Just a reminder for those of you listening, we are speaking with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal on the WINY Afternoon Show. Moving on to another topic I have over here, that's regarding the quadcopters, or drones as they're frequently referred to as. They're kind of growing in popularity lately amongst the general public and hobbyists, but they've also caused a lot of controversy surrounding privacy issues, surrounding safety issues, especially after we had this story that had made headlines with a Central Connecticut State University student who made this, apparently it was completely legal, this drone that flies around and it can actually shoot with a handgun. So our question to you is, should the federal government play a more active role in regulating drones, and what are your views on their weaponization by private citizens?
Very, very important question, John. In fact, very pertinent right now, because I'm actually joining and writing legislation to address the gap or lapse that we have. In a way, it's a loophole with respect to protecting the public against misuse of drones. The loophole essentially is that commercial drones are overseen and regulated by the federal government, specifically the FAA, but recreational or hobbyist drones are not. So the drone you just described, which had some weaponry attached,
right,
because it was a recreational drone, was unregulated. And that's wrong. We need to protect people against invasion of privacy, potential public health and safety threats, and that's why I'm proposing legislation that would close that loophole or gap, and I'm going to be announcing the details, in fact, next week.
So here's another topic that's been on the minds of a lot of people lately, and that's about how last month we had the 50th anniversary of Medicare, and you've been critical, as I understand, of efforts in Congress to privatize Medicare and to turn it into a voucher system is another proposal that we sometimes hear. Could you explain why you disagree with those who argue that reducing the government's direct role in the program that's the Medicare program, is what's best for the country.
I think the government has a opportunity to set standards and criteria so that people's health needs are met. As Attorney General, I can't tell you the number. It was countless times people were denied coverage by their health insurer, and I went to bat for them. I was their advocate. When they said that the treatment was experimental for a brain tumor and therefore wouldn't be covered, when they said that the treatment was for a pre-existing condition, a standard ruse from the insurance companies, I said, no, you should cover it. I dealt again and again and again with some of the abuses from health insurance companies. They're maybe well-intentioned in some ways, but let me be very blunt. If it weren't for some of the intervention by public standards, public criteria, healthcare might be at a lower level than it is now. So I think the Medicare and Medicaid systems have a role, not just in providing resources, but setting standards so that we hold the providers, the hospitals, the insurance companies, the private industry to a high standard. I recognize they are professionals. They have good intentions, but sometimes there are needs for protection of the public. And there's an effort, as you probably know, to privatize Social Security. I have fought playing games with Social Security. I'm going to fight any effort to privatize Medicare or Medicaid. And frankly, the wind has gone out of those sails. The folks who may have advocated it have really, I think, been pushed back, because what we see is the Affordable Care Act actually working. You know, it's worked here in Connecticut. It's worked around the country. And I think health care, particularly preventive health care that saves dollars and saves lives, has reached a lot of consensus.
And whereas Medicare is, of course, a topic that impacts primarily a lot of the older citizens in the state of Connecticut and throughout the country, there's one topic I think that particularly stands out for younger Americans in their teens and 20s, and that's regarding student loan debt refinancing. Now, with that being a concern that's growing the student debts throughout our entire country, we were wondering, what are some of the key strategies you believe should be taken to ensure students are able to pay off their debt or avoid getting into debt altogether? What are your views on efforts by Congress to allow student loans to be refinanced? And should we hold colleges and universities to higher standards in terms of how they must incorporate debt-reducing strategies if they are to continue receiving effective subsidization through their student federal loans?
I think that the focus really has to be on lowering the cost and tuition expenses of college students generally so that debt is avoided, and also providing more Pell Grants, better means for students to avoid the tremendous financial obligations they have now. I think the average is about $50,000, $60,000 just for college, and then talk about graduate school, even higher. That's a burden on them. Often takes years to alleviate or eliminate. It's also a burden on our economy. Those graduating students can't start families, buy new homes, begin businesses. They can't participate in our economy. That's bad for our economy. So here are some very specific solutions. Number one, more Pell Grants, measures to provide incentives for colleges and universities to lower the cost of tuition, maybe eliminating some of the frills, some of the pay increases for administrative staff. There are ways, I think, to use resources more effectively, but also, as the president's proposed, making community colleges tuition-free by providing federal investment. It's not spending, it's not funding, it's an investment. We're investing in people. Those are the people who are going to be our inventors and entrepreneurs and teachers and firefighters, public servants. And here's what I also propose. Those people who engage in public service ought to be able to work down their debt. In other words, they should be rewarded and recognized for being firefighters or teachers or policemen or other public servants, even in the private sector. That debt ought to be worked down. They ought to be given credit against their debt for that public service by the federal government. Number two, let them refinance at lower interest rates. Some of them now are 8, 10%. You know, if you have a mortgage or a car loan, you can refinance it. Go to the bank. I want a lower interest rate. Can't do that with with debt that students have. So interest on student debt ought to be lowered through refinancing. And then I think also when folks start right now, the interest rates ought to be lower. The major banks can go to the Federal Reserve and they borrow for close to zero. Those big banks can borrow money for close to zero. Why should students be paying the interest rates they are now? The federal government uses students as a profit center. Our nation is profiting billions of dollars off the backs of students. That's wrong. We ought to be investing in students.
Now, Senator, speaking of financing, this is actually just something that came to my attention maybe about an hour ago. We got a message from your team a little bit about an initiative that you're helping to take regarding credit reporting agencies and being held accountable for errors that might be made. Could you tell us a little bit about this initiative? Because it's a little bit new to me.
People don't realize how often credit reporting agencies make mistakes. As a U.S. senator, I hear from people all the time who say, you know, I went to apply for a job, and they told me I'd failed to pay a debt. They check with a credit reporting agency. I had no idea. Well, people should be able to correct those errors that credit reporting agencies have because they preclude you from buying a car or sometimes having a new job. And I don't think employers, by the way, ought to be able to check your credit before they hire you. I don't know how it's relevant, but even if they can check, it ought to at least be accurate. So this initiative would enable people more easily and readily to correct any errors and know about them in the first place.
And here's a little bit of a fun topic here, Senator. It's New England, so of course we love our seafood over here. And as I understand, coming up in September, I believe it's September 25th, it's going to be National Lobster Day, as I understand, and that's going to also sort of segue a little bit into a conversation about some legislation, as I understand, the Restoration and Stewardship Act for Long Island Sound. Could you tell us a little bit about what that does and why it's important for people in Connecticut in the fishing industry?
I'm proud to have co-sponsored. My colleague and friend Chris Murphy is a co-sponsor with me, and all the New England senators are on board. A resolution for National Lobster Day. People all around the country love lobster. We ought to be trying to create a national market, a stronger national market for it. So raising awareness is a good thing to do. But I also believe very strongly that the lobster die-off we've seen in Long Island Sound reflects issues with pollution, runoffs of fertilizer, the increased temperature of Long Island Sound, which may reflect climate disruption, global warming. There is a need to focus on the health of Long Island Sound. I grew up on Long Island Sound. I swam at a time when people really assumed Long Island Sound was clean, and it was compared to then a time afterward when it went through a lot of pollution. It's cleaner now than it was then. And we need to treasure and protect Long Island Sound from pollution. So this Stewardship Act would provide the resources that are necessary to continue cleaning up Long Island Sound. And we have sponsored it with our colleagues across the Sound, our colleagues from New York. It's a joint proposal, and we're going to continue to work on it.
And Senator Blumenthal, the last question that I have for you today. While President Obama acknowledged he didn't watch the first presidential debates of this season last week, we were curious if you did. If so, do you feel the debate set the stage for constructive policy discussions during the primary and general elections of 2016? Which, if any, of the points raised during the debate stood out as relevant to your concerns as a U.S. senator, either in an agreeable or disagreeable way?
I'm going to put aside the most prominent part of the debate, which obviously are the comments made by Donald Trump.
I think a lot of people would agree that's the part that captured the headlines the most.
It captured the headlines, and frankly, I don't know how he gets away with saying a lot of what he does, but he has a following. Let me just say, I think that these debates are very revealing, particularly on some of the social issues. These candidates clearly have said they're against a woman's right to choose, reproductive rights enshrined in the Constitution. I've fought very hard to protect those rights. I have been one of the leading Senate fighters against the effort to defund Planned Parenthood, which, as you may know, provides essential cancer screening, prenatal care, other kinds of women's health care service. Only 3% of what it does relates in any way to abortion. And what it does essentially on family planning is to prevent unwanted or unintended abortions. So I think that these debates were revealing on their opposition to the Affordable Care Act, health care for everyone, health care for women, social issues, reproductive rights, and other kinds of issues where I think, for example, their position on immigration is one that I reject. It's against providing a path to earned citizenship. I helped write the bill that received overwhelming bipartisan support in the Senate, a major step in the right direction. Unfortunately, the House didn't adopt it, but I'm going to try to bring it back. And I hope that we will see a path to earned citizenship that will receive bipartisan support, but it didn't in those debates. And I think it will set up, these debates on the Republican side will help to set up the broader debate that will go through in this country in the coming election.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Blumenthal. We appreciate your time very much. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up before we go?
I am really honored to be here talking to veterans particularly, and I hope that every veteran knows that I'm going to be working and fighting for them, because this country in many ways has failed to keep faith with our veterans. My mantra is leave no veteran behind. I know that this part of the state really believes in supporting its veterans on this anniversary of ending the Second World War. Especially, we should be mindful of the debt that we owe to our veterans. Freedom is never free, and we should remember always the burden and the debt that we owe our veterans, the burden that they have held, and the great work that they've done in protecting our freedoms.
Well, a big thank you to U.S. Senator from Connecticut, Richard Blumenthal. We appreciate your time stopping by today, and we hope that you have a great day today in northeastern Connecticut. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Take care as well.
WINY Putnam. Hear us live online anytime from home or work at winyradio.com.